Today is January 24th, 2013. We are here in the D.H. Hill Library at North Carolina State University to interview Dr. Robert G. Sargent of Syracuse University. My name is James R. Wilson, and I'm on the faculty at NC State University. And we're interviewing Dr. Sargent as a part of the Oral History Project, sponsored by the National Science Foundation within the activities of the Simulation Archive here at NC State University. Bob Sargent is a leader in the field of simulation, as evidenced by the professional recognition he has received. He is a fellow of the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences, INFORMS, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. Bob has received the Distinguished Service Award and the Lifetime Professional Achievement Award from the INFORMS Simulation Society. He has also received the WSC, the Winter Simulation Conference Board of Directors Award, and the Association for Computing Machinery Distinguished Contributions Award. It is also noteworthy that for Bob's work on verification and validation of simulation models, he received the 40th Anniversary Landmark Paper Award from the Winter Simulation Conference in 2007. Bob, we'd like to start by asking you, what led you to the field of simulation?
Well, I returned to graduate school at the University of Michigan. I got a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. I worked for 2.5 years with Hughes Aircraft on the electronic system F-106, which did have a computer, which was had a drum and relays and electronic tubes, but we didn't program it. And when I went back to graduate school to get a master's degree, I wanted to design large-scale systems. One of the first course I had to take was in data processing. In that course, we learned the Michigan MAD language, Michigan Algorithm Decoder, and learned about computers. And the last third of the course was on discrete event simulation. There was no book. A professor named Richard C. Wilson taught us, and I just loved it. It just seemed natural. It's just what I could visualize. So that's when I first learned about it. We had to do a project, and I did the simulation of something I was working with the Hughes Aircraft Company, with looking at interceptors, intercepting bombers, because I was working with the Air Defense Command. And so that was my project. Did a much larger project than required. And so then I finished up my master's degree, and I learned about operation research. And at the last minute, I decided to stay for a PhD because I wanted to learn something more. I was offered Ford Foundation a Faculty Development Award that if you taught for 2 years, you have to pay that money back. And then one summer, I had a National Science Foundation grant. And so I took a graduate course from somebody from the University of Michigan, Willow Run Labs, where they did some of the very early simulation work. And so I just got in simulation, and I did consider doing my dissertation in simulation and queuing system, looking at transient response with Ralph Disney, but I ended up working with somebody else who worked in control theory, which with electrical engineering background, Hugh Bradley. He had got a degree out of, PhD out of Johns Hopkins under George Nemhauser, but his bachelor's and master's in control theory at MIT. So I ended up doing my PhD dissertation looking at use of control theory for managing inventory systems. But my exposure and how I got into that was back to this class taught by Dick Wilson at the University of Michigan, and it just seemed to, I found my home.
Well, tell me about, beyond Professor Wilson, the other individuals who influenced you most in your early career in simulation.
Well, I don't think there's any one specific people. I think it was just people working. I just was interested in field learning. Of course, I went to Naylor, was involved with the Timms College on Simulation and Gaming. And I think about, I got my PhD in 66, and I joined the faculty at Syracuse University for 2 years, although it turned out to be a lifetime working there professionally. Mm-hmm. But I think it's about in 67 or so that, or 68, Naylor had a conference at Duke in there. So I went to that conference, got to meet people, and I just sort of learned on my own. I read a variety of people, but I can't say there was one specific mentor that I had in simulation. I mean, there's Alan Pritzker and other people doing it, but it was very early in the field. Schreiber eventually I got into Shriver's GPSS and met him and things, but there was no specific individual that there. It was just learning the literature and meeting the people in the field.
Okay. Tell us more about the persons, organizations, institutions, or tools, technical tools, that had the greatest impact on the direction of your career.
Well, I guess I would, I don't think there's any specific one, but again, but what happened when I got to Syracuse University, I wanted to work in applied field. I wanted to have my work be useful. And so when I got to Syracuse, the reason I went to Syracuse is because they had a program called System Information Science that was IBM supported. And we had off-campus programs, so I could teach in that, and it was only a graduate program. But that was the reason I went there. But when I got there, I found out they had a very close tie and working relationship with Rome Air Development Center of the Air Force in Rome, New York, which is a sort of applied research lab. And when I was, they had contracts with them and that. So I started working with them. The first thing I got there, and I started working with them. At first, I did computational ways of solving inventory problems numerically because I had to tie in a time-sharing system. Mm-hmm. But when I was in graduate school at Michigan, I had taken a course from guy traveled salesman problem. Anyway, it'll come back to me in a minute. But we had studied response surface analysis to search and become find the maximum minimum. And so I was using those kind of methods to search on a numerical surface that was essentially generating expected value in things. So I got working with Air Force, and they came and they wanted me to work in database. They said they sparked there. I said, no, I want to work in simulation. So I just started working with simulation, and we just developed a working relationship. And I had a very good experience there, so I never left Syracuse. And so the organization there, and so I just started working with them in simulation and going working on problems with them. And they support my work, and I support them, and it turned out to be a good relationship. So I think that was best I can answer that question.
Can you tell us more about major figures in the field of simulation who did not work directly with you or know you personally, but whose work had a large influence on your career and the direction of your work?
I think, again, I had broad interest. You know, of course, George Fishman had had worked in there, and Alan Pritzker had things, GPSS, Shriver, and so it was more of exposure to the literature in the field in that way. So, again, I just sort of went and just kept digging through, and, you know, Naylor and all the people had the literature, so I was really just interacting and getting involved.
In this connection, you've organized many sessions at conferences over the course of the past four decades. Could you comment on the simulation pioneers who participated in some of these sessions and give us your recollections of those individuals?
Well, I think probably the first person that got really developed simulation, wrote the first book, was Tolker, Dr. Tolker, in the United Kingdom. So I had him come and give a talk. He was in industry, and then he went to academia. And so at the 1981 IFORS conference in Hamburg, Germany, I asked him to come and give a talk. He did, and unfortunately he died shortly thereafter. Okay, but I had a number of people come and give talks. People from England, and, you know, doing witness and had graphics stuff. Alan Pritzker, others. So I guess I was very fortunate. I learned that if you ask these people, you know, how big the names were, they would generally come. They're very nice people. That's one thing about the simulation community, is that they're very friendly, very helpful, and no egos. And they're just very accommodating bunch of people. So you'd ask them, and they'd come. Whether it's Lee Shruman or Dick Nance or whoever you asked, they would generally come.
Tell us about your the various aspects of your research. Let's start with modeling methodology. Could you tell us something about the various initiatives you've undertaken and research initiatives in the area of modeling methodology?
Well, I've worked in different areas, and I think if we looked at simulation language, it was just sort of coming out. I got my PhD in 66, and so early on I developed a couple of tutorial kinds of papers and talks. One was Introduction to Simulation Languages, because people weren't even aware of, had very little knowledge of the different kinds of simulation languages, and so I developed that. But there's also, in the 70s, there was this thing sponsored by SIGSIM called Symposium on the Simulation Computer System. So the second one, I said, what am I going to do for a paper? I said, well, computer science is always saying they don't know how to do any statistics. So I got a paper on output analysis. And this was very well accepted at conference, and the computer scientists started handing out in their classes. And I think it had a major impact. For about 10 years, and of course that got me interested in looking at a little bit of output analysis, and I did some work over my career on and off with output analysis. I was interested in, like Dick Nance was, in terms of time flow mechanisms, how you move a model through time, and how do you model? And, you know, Kivia had written some fundamental papers on that at the RAND Corporation, so it tied in getting into the simulation languages, because the languages had specific worldviews. Mm-hmm. And so I worked there, and then I did work in modeling, and then and developed different ones. I worked with interact a little bit with Lee Shubin on event graphs. And then I had some more, and we moved into parallel simulation. We developed something called control flow graphs, which allow people to model, and they could execute either in sequential processing or parallel processing. Mm-hmm. That, and then I think it was about 87, I think. Anyway, CACI asked me to give a talk on validation of models, and so then I. Give a talk there, and then there was Energy NSF conference. I was asked to give a talk on validation of models. So I got started in validation models, and this tied into my work I was doing with the Rural Development Center, because they had asked me, and the division I was working with was doing a lot of work on modeling of computer systems. And we were looking at analytical methods and using simulation sort of to see how the analytical methods behaved, and so then it was validation. So, and when you're working with the Air Force and real problems, you want to know how good the models behave, and so it all sort of tied into validation. I sort of was evolving. And then they give me had a contract with them as how do we make validation. I developed what I labeled a simplified view of the modeling process that showed verification and validation, which has become rather well known. And so that sort of came out of the rural area development again. But again, it was boiled down to my interest in having practical things that works. And so give a sample there. And I've been very fortunate that verification and validation is a topic that I did a lot of work in. And it was an area that wasn't really well defined when I started in it, and it sort of helped formalize that area. I guess you going to ask another question here, or you want me to talk about more?
I was just going to say that I think you are widely recognized as the foremost expert in the world on simulation, verification, and validation. And another area that you haven't mentioned that you're also widely recognized in is the field of hybrid simulation, which you haven't mentioned at all. Do you care to elaborate on that?
Well, there was a fellow named George Shantikumar, who was a young faculty member, and he was very analytically oriented. And he and I interacted on developing queuing models of computer systems, one for computer performance evaluation. And so he and I were talking, and we ended up writing a paper in hybrid modeling. And I did probably. One of my students, Harold Anderson, who was an IBM employee, came up from Yorktown Heights area, and we did one of the first. He had one of the first dissertations on modeling of computer systems, and there's one going on at Harvard, Buzin was the person. There's another person at Michigan called Kip Moore and Harold Anderson. They had the first three dissertations, as far as I know, for computer performance evaluation. Now, what we did different at Syracuse is we had got real data off a computer at IBM Watson Research Center, and we analyzed it. Okay, the others didn't really have data, and we took an analyze and showed that the variables could be looked at as a Poisson process. In fact, we worked stuff by David Peter Lewis. We used his analysis programs and to analyze that. And then furthermore, we analyzed the demands on the computer system, and a lot of most analytical models use exponentials. These aren't exponential, they're hyper, long tails. Mm-hmm. And then my feeling was, my experience with queuing models, that wasn't going to work very well. And so this Harold Anderson dissertation was a simulation model where we looked at different scheduling rules for time-shared computers. Well, the other two dissertations I mentioned, they used queuing network models at exponential service times, and I would let my student do that because I just think that wasn't going to work very well. Mm-hmm. It turns out under certain cases, using exponential distribution does give reasonable mean expectation times, but we looked at scheduling rules, and Harold Anderson went back to IBM and many scheduling rules put in the time-shared computers from IBM were based on his work. Okay, so we did that. So I did a lot of work there, and over time, looking at computer performance evaluation, Rome Air Development had models that used to work with them on look at how we can run their computing center more efficient. Okay, a lot of that's not put in the literature. But we looked, George Shane Kumar and I did some joint queuing network models and also for simulation output models. Now, another area that I worked in was in looked at the event list for efficiencies in terms of that. Now, I had this problem of looking at event lists, how are we going to analyze these? And I had it for several years, but I never had the right student that I felt could really handle it, because you had to have a very unique background. And so I had Bill McCormick came here. He was a graduating math number one from Whitaker College in California. He's valedictorian university. He came and we worked with him, and I said, here's a nice problem you want to work at. And so he was able to do nice analytical analysis as well as some simulation analysis of the event list, and that is considered one of the classic papers, if not the classic paper in event list. We developed some very efficient ways to look at and analyze that that hadn't been done before.
I think it would be fair to say that paper is regarded as the landmark in the area of event list algorithms and event list analysis.
Thank you.
What about your work in inventory and production systems? Do you care to elaborate on that?
Well, my PhD dissertation was in looking at an inventory system using linear control theory, and people in the inventory system didn't believe you could use control theory. To me, it was just another modeling method. It was just, and so I proceeded to do that. But what I was looking at was the design of inventory systems in my dissertation. We called the variable S inventory model because the level S varied depending upon that. And used for the feed forward, we used the Box-Jenkinson forecaster, which was just brand new. It hadn't really hit the streets yet. And I was using feedback to control this. And I tried getting it published. I get one publication. Most people say, well, we optimize inventory system, minimize cost. And I said, well, I'm looking at the behavior of how you can control inventories. And people said, well, you can't use the Box-Jenkinson forecaster because it's not practical. Well, it's a very common use today. So I guess my opinion was I was probably 10 years ahead of my time. And one of the inventory guys at Michigan refused to be on my PhD committee because he said that he was well-known in inventory systems because he said that inventory would not work. And so I was looking at transient behavior. But what was interesting to me is another fellow called Harvey Wagner who had written books in operation research. And years later, he started doing some real-world inventory analysis. And pretty soon, he found out that the demand did vary. You needed to look at how you could control it versus trying to just develop analytical models that optimize cost. And so It was an interesting experience. Now, I took a number of control courses at Michigan and mathematic courses, but frankly, it got beyond my skill because they had to get an omnibus control, and I just didn't, even though I took the mathematic courses, it just wasn't me. Simulation was me because I can visualize models and it work in that direction. I can't push mathematics around as many other people can, so I just didn't have those kind of skills nor interest to do that. One other thing that I talked about, the event list behavior in terms of computation efficiency, I looked at parallel simulation and looked at algorithms, and that was control flow graphs I mentioned as a modeling method, which is for the process worldview, which is really not a graphical modeling method used today. And so we developed a number of algorithms, but unfortunately a couple of students I had working in never finished their PhD for some different reason. But those algorithms, people told me that experiments with them work better by being automated than trying to build them manually. And I also don't think the people that was trying to do what's called PADS, parallel and distributed simulation, are really using the right approach. I think you need to have a modeling approach, and you can just flip the switch in terms of what kind of computational methods you use. So I had some, we got a number of papers out, but unfortunately only one student got his PhD, Thomas Somm, who went to IBM, who's done extremely well there. But the other two students, they went off and did other things, although they're extremely capable. They just weren't disciplined enough, or I didn't handle them enough to get their PhDs.
Well, tell us more about your work on the theory of simulation and kind of give us some idea of how that is differentiated or distinguished from your work in modeling methodology and model execution. And
okay, well, part of the Rome, I mentioned the Rome Air Development Center. At one point in time, I had a huge contract. I was supporting Lee Shrubin and some of his students at Cornell. And I had four or five students. And one of the students was Syracuse in the computer science, which is a system information science program I mentioned earlier, moved into be called computer science. They had some people in artificial intelligence and in logic programming. And so one of my students, Ash Radhika, had taken a lot of logic programming and things. And so we used the logic theory approach to take and look at the simulation. Now, Bernie Ziegler had used system theory in terms of looking at that. So I had a few papers with this student, and his PhD student, PhD was looking at use of sort of logic programming in terms of developing the theory of simulation. But, you know, it's nice theoretical, but it's not one of those areas that's going to be, I don't think, become practical in the sense of having a language that will proceed to do that. But I think it's worthwhile to have theory developed from different ways to see what you can learn from things. One thing I always had all my students do, the PhD students, is have a thorough understanding of Bernie Ziegler's book on terms of the theory using general system theory, although again some of that may not be practical, but I think it's great conceptually to understand how systems behave. Well, simulation systems.
You're mentioning the implementation of simulation theory and language naturally leads us to the question about your work in software development.
Well, I mentioned control flow graphs, and my work was sponsored by Rome Air Development Center. And so we had money and we developed a prototype using control flow graphs that had sequential processing as well as a few of the parallel algorithms, because there's different ways, conservative and optimistic and so forth. But we did that. We developed it to show that this method would work. And we did do a couple of military problems in it and some others. So we developed it. And then related to that, had another student. Well, I had a student that come from, when the wall went down in Berlin, okay, the people behind the wall got some money from the West German government. So I used University of Magdeburg and started interacting with them. The reason that came about was because of Tom Schreiber. Tom Schreiber knew German. You know those people, so, and the people in German in the University of Magdeburg knew of me, Mm-hmm. And it's primarily because of the Winter Simulation Conference. So I was known to those people, and then Tom Schreiber's told him that he knew me, and so there as some students. So one of the students came, Thorsten Dahm, and he was one that helped work on the language that I had there. Then we also looked at experimental frames, and it was put in the special issue of the IE transaction, I guess, dedicated to Alan Pritzker. And
yes.
We had a paper on experimental frames in there, and we looked at trying to update what specifically Bernie Ziegler also had done earlier, but technology has changed. As we all know, computer technology rapidly changed, so to bring it up to the latest computer technology. So we looked at developing experimental frames with respect to that. So that tied in again to the Rome Air Development Software work, where we had the control flow graphs. It's a modeling method. We had computation algorithms, and then we had the experimental frame concept in terms of how we designed the language.
Okay. Next, we'd like to talk about some of the motivations and for your work, the various considerations that have influenced the direction of your work, things like research sponsorship or contracted problem solving or just specific applications or perhaps just sheer intellectual curiosity. What we really like to hear is something about is what sort of motivated the work that you've pursued.
Well, I went to Syracuse for 2 years, Syracuse University. I got my PhD. My objective was to go to industry. I want to work on large-scale systems design, air traffic control system, large-scale military system. And so I started working with Rome Air Development Center. I was in the command and control group or division. And so we worked on applied problems. And so what I used to do with them, or my relationship with them, was that I would go with them on their contracts to the different places or go at the meetings where they had problems. And I could sit there and listen and get problems defined or help them on the technical aspects of their contracts. But then I could get real-world problems, and I could bring them back to Syracuse, and they give me some money. It was giving me money to support graduate students, so I had real problems to work on, and I always wanted, when things I developed, I always wanted to be useful, put it into use, some practicalness. So as you may have seen in my career, I moved across different technology areas, and that's possibly because of possible creativity, I was seeing that was needed by the Air Force. Where there might be some money with the Air Force, because they get money allocated, interested students. Okay, but I have broad interests. Some people have very narrow interests, and I had broad interests, but I always wanted to have something that was practical and useful. And if you look at my things like a vet list, that was something that could be implemented. If you look at verification, validation, there's something there. Modeling was something that everybody has to do. So what was my motivation is an area that I saw that was could be researched, that had some need for it, and I thought I and my students could be do something productive.
Could you comment on why you came to view simulation as one of the primary tools for the applications that your work addressed?
Well, simulation gives a solution, and maybe I'll go back to one of the things I tried doing in my career. When I got out of school in 66, I went to Syracuse, and there was no simulation, and I started developing simulation. But when I got out of school, when I did my PhD, the standard was that everybody knew that simulation was a technique of last resort. That was a view of many in the operation research community. It was nothing but a programming exercise. Anybody can do it, and there's no academic respect. And of course, that is, those are wrong. And so I view it this way. You think of a rock at the bottom of a hill. Some of us worked over our professional careers to move that rock to the top of the hill. But it goes in little steps, so people come along, they never saw the rock moved. And that's the way I view it, because why we want the rock at the top of the hill? So the field has academic respect, so we can research publications, It's still a technique of last resort in some sense, but that's because we can't solve the problems with using analytical models. So we have a very practical solution. So I think I was one of those individuals, or at least I view one of my individuals, that helped push that rock to the top. Okay, and I think today we have academic respect, we have journals, departments, things that publish things in, people think is a legitimate academic area. So some of us helped push it up there, and the reason I use that analogy is that people look and they say, don't think there's much going on, and people won't look at me and probably many others that we spent effort, considerable effort in our professional career to move that rock to the top, because it moves so slowly. If you come along and somebody won't not even notice it's moved, but if you come down 3 years later, 5 years later, you may see the rock has been moved 3 feet, you know, to get to the top. And so none of us, or probably most of us that put effort into this, will receive very little credit because it's just not recognized. But I think those of us who graduated in the 60s who wanted to work in simulation, many of us worked to push that rock to the top. And I'm not trying to say that we should receive any credit, but I just think it's area because of what we did. It's just not recognized because we were moving the rock inch by inch, and it's just not visible what was occurring. So I put much effort into it. And I'll just give one example. When I was right at the beginning of my career, worked with others, specifically through the Timms College Simulation, to get a simulation department in management science. And we got one there. Okay, so who should become the editor? Well, it was very clear to me, you need to have somebody that has some academic respect. Now, a field that had academic respect was statistics. So my feeling was that he became the first editor of that was George Fishman. He was working in the statistical analysis of output analysis. So he became there, and the people in the other areas couldn't say that it didn't have academics. Secondly, George had very high standards, which we also had to have in order to develop academic respect. You know, and that department was going to be closed on three different occasions that I'm aware of, because Marty Stark called me and said that we're not getting enough papers, not enough being accepted. Well, it takes a while to develop academic respect and get the appropriate level of papers. The first time I told him, well, we'll work on getting more papers, so we put some effort in. The second time we called, that's how the Timms College on publication, which now is a general one, but initially it was just for only management science. That's how that came about. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the third time is when I became editor, department editor for the research contributions and communication of ACM. Marty called him and said, well, we don't need this department of management science anymore. You can publish in the CACM. And so my response was, there's the computer side and the modeling side, and they're different. And we need to have both departments. Of course, I stress the differences more than the commonalities, so that we kept that department, and you know, the department of simulation is still in management science today. So that's just one example of trying to do it. Second example, maybe the Winter Simulation Conference. I worked to keep that going when that run the difficulty. So the thing is, there's a journal called TOMAX that was established. That was another, you know, mm-hmm. push up the hill when a communication ACM discontinued the research publication there because they wanted to change the nature of that publication. And Dick Nance of Virginia Tech had the idea of getting a journal in ACM, and I, along with Steve Roberts and some others, we worked and was able to accomplish that. So these are just examples of trying to push that rock up the hill, which I believe has occurred.
This naturally leads us to a discussion of the full spectrum of your service to the profession. And I'd like to ask you to comment specifically on your work in service to the Inform Simulation Society, the Winter Simulation Conference. I'll mention some other areas, but I just want to kind of get the ball rolling and let you give us your perspective on your service to the profession. And instead of trying to dictate some order in which these things go, I'll just let you kind of talk about the things in the way that feels most natural.
Well, I have performed a lot of service. I guess grew up in a family where, you know, I was in 4-H growing up and did things. My father used to do things like go around and collect dimes when they had March of Dimes and stuff. So I guess it was just sort of natural that I start doing service work. And so put considerable effort in providing service to the simulation community. And with the, used to be called the Tim's College and Simulation Game Make, I'm very active in that and held the various officerships in that. Of course, that's now evolved into the Informed Simulation Society. So I did a number of projects and efforts within the Tim's College Simulation Game, for example, the Management Science Department, Simulation Department of Management Science that I mentioned. Okay, I got involved with the Winter Simulation Conference very early, and it so happened that I replaced Alan Pritzker at the end of the WSC 74, and there were some difficulties, and 75 was not held, the Winter Simulation Conference. And there's no action being taken, so I thought about this and come up with an idea how to get that involved going again. And Paul Roth, who worked the National Bureau of Standards, now called NISC, was chair of SIGSIM. And Paul and I was working, although I wasn't holding any officers, but I was interacting very heavily with Paul on the symposium and the simulation of computer systems, because I was working with Romare Development Center, and that was part of the area there. And so I can see the idea of redoing the Winter Simulation Conference. So I worked with Paul, and we got that going again, and we held in 1976 at the National Bureau of Standards, and I was a general chair in 1977. As part of my effort to do that, I established a set of bylaws and board of directors for the Winter Simulation. That structure basically is still in operation, although it's had fine tunings one would respect. So I was general chair of the 1977 Winter Simulation Conference after serving as associate program chair in the 1976 Winter Simulation Conference. And so I've been actively participating in that conference for many, many years. In fact, this is first year since 1978 that I haven't had a paper in WSC 2012. But I was on the board of directors and chair of the board of directors for that conference, so I had a major effort into reestablishing that conference as it had a failure because of the lack of, in my opinion, a structure for managing the conference. So the Winter Simulation Conference, I've been sessions and many things, and as well as getting tutorials on verification and validation of the models. And as I said, I've had at least one paper at every conference there from 78 to 2011.
I think it would be fair to say that you've held every position in the Informed Simulation Society and the Winter Simulation Conference, not just once, but many times over.
Well, I don't know about many times over, but certainly I've held all of them at least once. And as I say, I do a lot of professional service work, and so it's satisfying, or I wouldn't do it. My objective is not to get credit for myself, but try to make these organizations work. And I was also involved in getting the information. We used to have a society called a section within Informs for the simulation. So I was involved in converting that from, I guess it was called a section, to a society. So I was involved in writing those bylaws and other things. Mm-hmm. Related to that is that, as most people know, that Jim Wilson was one that raised, when he was on the board of directors, raised a considerable amount of money for as insurance policy for the Winter Simulation Conference when they were having possible financial problems. And the board of directors of the Winter Simulation Conference asked me and four others to find some mechanism to handle that money. And the other four decided that I guess I was the one, since I had just recently retired, that I had the time to put into developing some kind of structure for that. So I was the one that essentially defined and laid out the structure for the WSC Foundation, could see the name of it, come up with the positions and so forth. Of course, we always had a lot of interaction with the other members providing feedback, but I was one that's down the trenches doing that. But if I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't be doing it.
Like the bylaws for the Winter Simulation Conference Board of Directors, you also wrote the bylaws for the WSC Foundation, did you not?
Yes, I wrote many of the iterations, although Dick Nance, I think, as I recall, wrote one of the iterations. But I wrote the initial one and most of the iterations. And so, but since I did the WSC bylaws, mm-hmm. I was one that was tasked to do the foundation bylaws. But I could see the name of the foundation. That was a sort of a controversial issue, whether it should be called the WSC Foundation or not. But that was one of the battles I won. I did lose some other battles when we were trying to put that the group together, the foundation together, but that's to be expected. You know, you don't, if you get 80%, you're doing lucky. My feeling is if you get 50%, you're doing well.
You've also rendered significant service to a number of other simulation-related professional societies. Would you care to comment on your service to this special interest group on simulation, SIGSIM, of the Association for Computing Machinery, and work with the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, the Computer Society of IEEE, and the Society for Computer Simulation International?
Well, we'll do the last one, SCS, Simulation Computer Society. I was on the board of directors. They elected one at large, so I went to the meetings and expressed my views. Okay, I didn't really hold any offices or do anything real specific other than try to be on the board and express some interest. It interested me because of my involvement with WSC of becoming involved, but I didn't get heavily involved. The IEEE computer group, again, they had an executive committee, and I was just expressed my views, but I was not heavily involved. And in SIGSIM, I didn't, again, hold any offices, but I had heavy interaction with some of the people like Paul Roth, I mentioned when we involved the WSC and the Symposium Simulation Computer System. So my relationship with that was informally but heavy mm-hmm. with officers in expressing my views. But I guess it's SIGSIM. I was also on some committees, for example, on the TOMAX, the committee that wrote the proposal for the journal TOMAX. I was on committees to help select editors and so forth. So I did committee service there, but an informal interaction, but I did not hold any officer positions.
As long as we're talking about all this service, a natural thing to ask about is your work in the conception of and the establishment of the Simulation Archive. Tell us about the genesis of that.
Well, I was thinking, I guess maybe as one gets towards the more end of the career and see other people get towards the end of their career, where does simulation come from? What are we saving about this? So I can see the idea of having the simulation archives, and I interacted with you, Jim Wilson, as you well know, that bounced it off, and you supported it and was able to get it established here at North Carolina State University, because that seemed to be a logical place, mm-hmm. a logical place. It could have been other logical places maybe, but this was known you were here, and so I think it's been a success to date. And I established endowment later, and that's become success, and with the great support from this institution and the library, as you indicated, was going to be occur. So I think we're off. That's why we're fortunate to have this NSF grant to do some oral histories, and hopefully it will continue to expand. But I think this will be something that will be worthwhile to society. And
I'd like to come back to your allusion to pushing a rock up a hill. In particular, all your work in establishing and promoting archival outlets for simulation research. And so I'd like you to tell us a bit more about your editorial work with, for example, the communications of the ACM. with SIGSIM, with TOMAX, and with the Journal of Simulation?
Okay, well, part of working in order to help establish, you know, push this rock uphill, get some more academic respect, you know, there was a 3 conferences held in New York City on simulation, a couple years apart. The first one, I just went, gave a paper, and a book come out. I think it's called The Current Issues in Simulation. And the next 2, Dick Nance and myself and another person, Nabil Adam, run those, and one of them was for a special issue of operations research. I think that was a well-received, well set of papers, and the other was a special issue of communication of ACM. Okay, well, unknown to me, Nabil Adam had proposed that there should be a department within the communication ACM, because that's where the research outlets were at the time. And one day, I just out of the blue, I got a call from the editor chief of the communications of ACM saying, I want you to be the department editor for simulation modeling and statistic computing. And it wasn't any, turns out that I was initial one for that department. And I said, well, I'm not sure I'm the best guy for this job, number one. And number two, I don't know much about statistical computing. And he says, well, you're the man. And he wouldn't back off. And so I said, well, I'll do the simulation part, but not the statistical computing. He says, well, that's what the department's going to be. And he says, I'll help you. If you get any papers, statistical computing, I'll help you find referees and we'll work that together. So it would just come out of the blue there. So I handled that department for 5 years. And I said, my style is I don't like to stay anything too long, so I move them out to get established. So after 5 years, I informed the people that I was going to retire from that position, to their unhappiness that I did. And so that was that position. Mm-hmm. The person who followed me as the department editor was Dick Nance. And after a couple years, Communication ACM decided that they were no longer going to have research publications there, and Dick had the idea of establishing a journal within ACM for that, so I become involved with that, and I interacted with Dick on that after it was formalized. I served on the editorial board. There's the Journal Simulation, which is a journal that was established by the Operational Research Society of England. And when that journal was established, I was approached and I agreed to serve and help guide that journal. And I think it won't be long, my time would be plenty to be on that journal to be off. So and the same thing with TOMAX, when I think one of the new editors come in, I said, you need to appoint some new people, you need new blood, new ideas. Because my belief is you should turn it over, get other people in there and move on. And let other people get. Now, when you do that, there's going to be changes that you're not always going to be happy with. But that's part of the change. New blood, new ideas, and it may not be what you think is the best, but things survive. Did I hit all the journals you mentioned?
Yes. Is there anything else in particular in your work with SIGSIM, the ACM SIGSIM? Are there any other aspects of your editorial work with SIGSIM that we haven't discussed at this point?
Not that I think of, but you may have something on your mind, but I don't think there...
Well, I guess the only other thing that I was thinking about, did you have any role in the simulator, which was published by SIGSIM for an extended period of time.
No. Harold Joseph Highlander, that's what he liked to be called, a great big guy, was stature-wise, I mean physically large. Mm-hmm. No, he was working in it, and no, I was not involved with any work involved with it. I mean, I supported it, but I was not actively providing any service to simulator.
Would you care to elaborate on basically the chronology of your work, the periods over which various phases of your work was done, to give us some sense of the chronology of your career and when you did various pieces of the work that you've achieved over the last...
Well, I did methodology work through my whole career in simulation, and started with, as I alluded to, maybe the beginning was introduction to simulation languages and output analysis, and output analysis continued all the way through, and I developed with through students statistical things, but some of it was directed towards validation, because you had to compare the model and the real world data, and so you're comparing two stochastic processes, and so we did that. You have to look at equal variances, so we looked at some statistical stuff with variances. We did a thorough study of comparison of various just regular confidence interval estimators, Dave Goldsman and Kang, Kimban Kang. We wrote, I think, a very nice paper in that area through considerable analysis. I was doing more experimental work, and Kibon was helping me, and Dave Goldsman was doing more of the theoretical side of that. So I think that was a nice paper. So just scattered through was that. And then I was looking at computer performance evaluation, more system performance evaluation. We were looking at developing queuing models and that. So that went on for a number of years, and looking at both the simulation and analytical kinds of models. Then I got in validation, verification and validation, and that's still going, work going on today, developing and methods. And I had a student, Osman Balci, who went there and did his work under me. He joined Virginia Tech, and he did a lot of work. He was a little more on the verification side, although his dissertation was on the validation side. So that's in my latter part of the career, and that's still active. Performance evaluation maybe started somewhat early in my career, sort of informal, and then become more formal, and then moved on, and I haven't done really, I would say, formal methods. You mentioned production or inventory and production systems, and so we did some simulation with local industry, but it was more when there were specialized problems or George Chanti Kumar's area's production system. So we looked at models as the hybrid models that you mentioned there. So that was sort of the middle of the year, because George Chanti Kumar was at Syracuse maybe about 4 or 5 years, and good and bad, I went to Cornell for a year. Bill Maxwell, who was there, invited me down to work with the group down there. And George Chanti Kumar that year, I guess, missed me or something anyway. So he packed up and interviewed and left. And I guess he didn't have a colleague to interact with. So then when I came back to Syracuse, George wasn't there. So I really didn't do much more in terms of queuing type, formal queuing type models. I had one student, Chandra, who went to Penn State, who looked at numerical methods. Solving numerical queuing models using numerical methods. So that was sort of, I'd say, middle part of my career was on more computer performance evaluation, although I still look at a lot of stuff I do with system performance evaluation, but I'm not really active in research. So I was maybe a little bit chronic. I'm gonna give you some feeling over time of my research areas. I think that was what was you were trying to get at.
Right.
Modeling methodology continue, the topics change, but I was going there. Yes.
I'd like to turn now to a consideration of the, I guess, the environment in which simulation applications and research are conducted, and how that environment has changed over time. So can you tell us something about the prominent features of the technical environment in which you worked when you began your career, and compare and contrast that to the situation today, and tell us something about what you think the future holds in that connection.
Well, when I started, you know, we had at Michigan, we had an IBM 709 when I took that data processing course. It was the third, was on discrete event simulation. We wrote in the MAD language, Michigan over in Dakota, which is sort of like Fortran. We got turnaround time. It took 2 days. You had to go get your cards, punch your cards, run it, and maybe debug it in hexadecimal output. And so you tried to make sure you had no errors because on that. And so then over time, simulation languages come in a few years later, and then that is there. So we went from a machine that had very limited memory. They were sort of slow. They didn't have a fast turnaround time. And it took a lot of effort to get a program up and running, debugged, and that. And there wasn't much formal analysis techniques, many generation of random variates methods. Random number generators were very crude. Variance reduction techniques, people could do that, and that was very important in many of the military simulations because computers were slow and had limited memory. So any way they could figure out efficient ways to do that, and very interesting. And that's one thing I think the university. I don't know anything, very little about it, but the information I did hear know was that the University of Michigan Willow Run Labs, where they did some of the very early simulation, like at the RAND Corporation, there were some people there that was doing some apparently very good variance reduction techniques in order to reduce the run time. But that was all classified work, and so none of it's ever really come out. And so no doubt there's some reinventing of the wheel. So what I'm trying to say, things are very crude. There's no computer graphics, very little output. And if you jump ahead to today, you know, everything continues to evolve. Every aspect, whether it's output analysis or variance reduction techniques, computer speeds, computer graphics, animation. And so it's a considerably different world today in terms of how computers are run. People set up terminals, laptops, so you can have more power than the big computers we had when I was involved with this. So people doing simulation today have no idea how technology has changed. It's like I was talking about pushing a rock up the hill. Mm-hmm. Every time computer science improved the computers, whether it's hardware or software or new entities on it, such as graphics, it affected simulation. Regarding the future, I think simulation is going to be used starting with teaching kids in school. They're going to be able to visualize and see things just like they do in the real world. It's going to change, is changing the way thinking occurs, the problem solving. When I went through college, I mentioned before, or we got through, you know, simulation was looked down upon. It was the most popular way to solve problems, beating linear programming and that. I don't see those surveys anymore. I think it's accepted as a valid and very useful and highly used method for solving problems. Now, what's happening is the kind of problems we're attacking has become much more complex, and it becomes harder and harder to validate these things because there are just too many variables. And so that's going to be a problem, but they're going to develop larger and larger simulation as a technology. Computer technology allows that. You know, if I took a look at the research, you know, research tends to be theoretical at first, many cases before it becomes practical. I see in many areas there's a lot of theoretical stuff being developed, and I'm sure it's useful. I being practical, I want to develop that, but I think the field is expanding in every area of simulation, methodology area of simulation. It has their own set of literature, so in the future, one is not going to be able to know it all. Like when I went through school, you could sit down even the first few years I was teaching and doing research, you could read all the papers and all aspects of simulation. Today, it's difficult for one person to even concentrate in one sub-area or one methodology area, simulation, whether it's output analysis or languages or whatever it is. It's just so much knowledge is expanded, and I think knowledge is going to continue to expand.
Let's talk a little bit about the various sources of institutional and organizational support that you've had during your career. Could you tell us something about the institutional and organizational support that enabled you to complete your education?
Well, I was at Michigan, University of Michigan. I went back to get a master's undergraduate school. I worked my way through school. I come from a working class family, so I was working many jobs, and my grade point average no doubt showed where my effort was, and that was to get my education and not how much I learned. In graduate school, I worked for 2.5 years. I'm back to graduate school, and I support myself through my master's program because I had funds to do that. And then I decided to stay for the PhD. I was fortunate. I had many sources of support. They were starting a new research lab at Michigan's PhD program, and IE started in 1961. Dick Wilson, who had for data processing, was the first one to get his degree from there, and I graduated in 66. But there was a person called Dean Wilson who worked at the Willow Run Research Labs, apparently in simulation, and I never really discussed this or realized this until recently, that he apparently was there involved in some of that work. He had a bachelor's degree only, but he was the most creative guy I ever met. And so he had just gotten a research contract with the Air Force looking at duplications of electronic components, my undergraduate degree being electrical engineering, having to work with the Air Force with the F-106 interceptor and the MA-1 electronic system. I was a natural, so I went, and he hired me immediately. I was the first student hired in the Industrial System Research Lab that he established there. And so is that. I also started teaching, and so I was teaching an undergraduate course, first in introduction to operation research, then next in data analysis in that. And then I was put on some research contracts, control theory through electrical engineering department with my advisor, Hugh Bradley. And then I had NS National Science Foundation support one summer, and then I had the Ford Foundation, Engineering Faculty Development. So in graduate school, I had choices, and I did that for my graduate student support. When I went to Syracuse, I just started working with Rome Air Development Center, and they supported my work. Now, I did do things through them, like with Defense Mapping Agency in D.C., in terms of getting information from outer space and developing hard maps that the Army and the Air Force could use and then moved into their system. So I did. That was, again, a production engineering problem. How can they get this data and process it and get the stuff out as quickly as possible? So I looked at it as a production system. It was a different kind of production than you think of making a physical entity. Mm-hmm. It was a data entity that we had to do. So basically, and then in the state of New York, developed what was known as a case center, computer application software engineering, in order to stimulate business. So I did have some support from them, but basically 95% of my work was with Air Force support through that. I did work in what was known as the Space Defense Initiative, where under President Reagan they were trying to, and they're of course doing it today, was shoot down missiles with missiles, and so I was involved. That's also tied into part of the parallel simulation work, because those were large scale. That so I was involved in there, and I used to go out to Colorado to the base there. And again, MITRE and them had me do work on validation of models. And so then I did become a consultant, was to work on that project through MITRE cooperation and how to validate models. And we started getting some human experiments, how to have subjects do things in terms of that. But that program died because the person's in charge. So there was some outside money, but it was primary through Rome Air Development. Even the Space Defense Initiative was primary money, but it was looking at how to develop simulations of the mid-course part of that program. That was very interesting, and there's a lot of money in it for a while, and then the money sort of dried up for part of that.
Beyond financial support, are there any types of support that were provided by institutions or organizations, for example, Syracuse University, or any professional organizations that provided support of some sort that really was critical enabling you to do your work?
No, Syracuse is a private university, and it's unique in a way that if you can get money, you can do things as long as it's, you know, academically honest. So you had some freedom there, okay? Mm-hmm. But it was founded as a Methodist university, and a Methodist college, I assume, probably then. But it didn't have a large endowment, and so they didn't provide much institution record. But you had the standard teaching load of two courses, mm-hmm. plus your research, plus your service. But there was also something different and unique there, and I went there, as I alluded to earlier, that they worked with IBM, mm-hmm. and we had off-campus centers. And so we used to go off-campus and teach courses, and that's how departments had additional faculty members that would help improve their establishment, because you had increased faculty members, they have support. At one time, IBM had more Syracuse University degrees than any other institution. The reason, because they had master's students who go there, and they asked us to teach new courses or new topics. And so we would say, well, we need this here, and the faculty could go off and do that. So mm-hmm. that was interesting that they wanted something new. Robots. So if they wanted something special, that they'd say, you know, we'd like to have a course in this. And so the faculty member would develop it and then go teach it as part of their master program. You go off campus and teach it with Endicott or Poughkeepsie. We also had the same thing at Rome Air Development Center, which is at Rome, New York, which is near Utica, where the General Electric was. So we had these off-campus programs that were offering master's level, and a lot of them were unique courses. So that was that was interesting, because you sort of stayed the state of the art. And then we had Syracuse University had Iraq centers, where you go up on a lake, they had facilities. And so almost every summer we'd have some kind of conference up there, and we'd give talks, and people would you come and learn and mm-hmm. stay the art. So that was, again, something unique, is that you're always at the state of the art, have interaction people, IBM come, Rome Air Development people, and this mm-hmm. was also a way to keep up technically what was going on, and also mm-hmm. network for people to have money, to get money, okay?
Looking back over all of your professional career, what aspects of your educational and professional experience do you regard as being most critical in enabling you to do what you've done?
Well, I think you have to be motivated, mm-hmm. okay, and you have to get out and meet people, mm-hmm. and when there's different mechanisms that I mentioned to you, but and you have to have, I guess we always had computing facilities, mm-hmm. so we always had, not necessarily graphics, but you know, I always think we had the state-of-the-art IBM computers. Since we were tied in with IBM, we always had mm-hmm. good computers, and sometimes there'd be computers up there that being evaluated by computer people for IBM, and then we could use them. The work I mentioned that we did an output analysis with Kibom Kang and Dave Goldsman, mm-hmm. they had a computer up there that was being evaluated by computer engineering that we use. So we had all the time that you want. It's all free. You could just go and run mm-hmm. your output analysis, to which can be computation heavy, to do experiments to evaluate things numerically. And so we had that, so I guess that's what response to your question.
This leads us naturally to ask about your assessment of the impact of your work and the legacy that you have provided. Could you tell us something about what you consider to be the short-term and long-term impact of your contributions in simulation research and technology and practice?
Well, I think I mentioned the the statistic output analysis that the sort of tutorial on people that knew statistics would say, well, what the hell is new here? But I think that had an impact for maybe 10 years or so on the computer science education. And so I think even though it was this basically tutorial type knowledge that I wrote very early in my career, I think had a short-term impact or over a period of time, I think primarily on education, because many computer science people in simulation said we had that in classes that we used to teach output analysis with. So I think that's one example of a short one. And, you know, that in 10 years, you know, it's forgotten now. It's just there's books going on. I think I mentioned pushing the rock up the hill as one of many that was helping to push the rock up the hill. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that will, people won't recognize or know about that. And since even today, you know, I think you ask people, who are the ones that pushed the rock up the hill? Well, people don't know what you're even referring to in that area. So I don't think that's, I think it's an area I'm very pleased to have contributed to, but I don't think it's going to be, that's not really recognized or that. I think it had, has had a major impact on the field, but I don't think it's one that people recognize. I hope that the simulation archive will have a long-term effect in terms of proceeding to do that. And I think the area of verification validation has had an impact now, and I think that will be known for a period of time. Okay, so that, I guess that's the major things that I can comment on there.
We've already talked about how simulation has changed over your professional life and what you see as the future. Are there any other comments in that connection that you'd like to make about the past, present, or future prospects of the field?
Well, I think the field is going to, in terms of application, going to continue to grow because I think we see simulation in the large, I mean, thinking beyond just playing discrete event simulation or continuous or combined simulation or hybrid simulation, that's going to grow. It's going to be used for things because of visualization. You can see and do that, and you may walk in and just go to a room instead of going someplace physically. You walk in and see the same thing in a room that you think you're in the Rocky Mountains or someplace else. So I think it's going to be growing. I think it's going to be great for education, particularly for younger people. I think a grade in high school that have computers that they'll be able to see and visualize things on screens, three or four dimensions. I mean, room. You have there's a sky and the floor, and it's just like you're there. You're there, and I think it's it will eventually get there as costs come down, technology proceeds there. You know, education, instead of having a teacher in front of the room, you may be using a lot of these programs, and an educator or maybe somebody's just interaction help guide things, because it's, so it may change the form of education in terms of the style of how it's conducted. So there, so I think there's it's going to have a wide application area.
In the applications of your work that have been made by others, have you found that those uses were largely what you anticipated? Have there been any surprises in the uses or impact of the work that you've done that are notable that you'd like to comment on?
Well, I guess I would be I was hopeful, but it has not occurred to be more use in terms of the control flow graphs and that graphical approach in terms of the algorithms that was developed there. I just think that's could be a small pot of gold that's sitting there that has not been used. Verification validation has received well received, and I think that is that's very pleasing. To go there, my concern is one thing right now is that young people are so busy and there's so much pressure getting out young professionals in the field that they don't have time to do service work. that's a concern to me, because I think it's very important, because you learn and you can network, and the Winter Simulation Conference is a great vehicle for meeting and interacting with people, both on personal basis and intellectual basis, learning about it. But people's becoming so busy with the pressures of work today and the demands being placed on people, I just don't think that they're having time to do this, and I think it's a shame. I think society, in some sense, is the competition, move faster, faster, do more and more, is not healthy in terms mm-hmm. of the element. We generate more knowledge, but I'm not sure the rate and the pressure being put on the expected of people is healthy.
Well, this naturally leads me to the last question I'd like to ask you is, for a young person contemplating a career in the field of simulation, what advice would you give them about how they should proceed to build a career?
I'll go back to some of my own personal things. Number one in my life is integrity. Mm-hmm. And I believe young people, my advice to be, no matter whether it's in simulation or anything else, the first and foremost thing is to have integrity. Okay. The second thing is to do something that you're interested in. So if you're going to do simulation, hopefully you're highly interested in simulation. And if you're going to be a researcher in simulation, pick an aspect of it that you enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have to be motivated. If you enjoy it, you have to motivate it. I think you need some breadth so you have some flexibility. Okay. My advice, I give the talk to the PhD colloquium at the Winter Simulation Conference a few years ago. And one of the things I said was, you should spend a day a week doing some activity other than simulation that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And the comments I got back, well, people don't have time today to do that in order to get tenure. And I say, well, I still believe that you should be doing other things. So yes, you have to work hard and do that, get some breaths so you can be flexible, because you don't know where the future's going to hold for you. Have integrity, provide service. I believe in service. Obviously, my own career hopefully has followed that. Be friendly, be helpful. And so, you know, as far as what technical area they go to, I think you have to develop something that matches you. I mean, I indicated that I started looking at control theory in terms of my PhD dissertation. I mean, I did apply for a postdoc at MIT and decided I withdrew because I decided I did not want to do what I was being pushed to do. And Merle Flood was the person I was trying to think of that I had the response service analyst was a travel salesman problem. He ran Will Run Lab, is very well known operations researcher. You know, he was encouraging me to go there, because he's going to be there the following year. But, you know, I recognize that I took courses there that just didn't match me. Simulation matched me. Mm-hmm. And so I think you have to get something you enjoy and you work at it. But I think you need breadth for flexibility, because you don't know where life's going to do you. And I think you should have more in life out there. And this is more than simulation. But I guess that's my advice to a young person.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.